That's the one after 9:09, an American-style rock and roll road tune that the Beatles played in their earliest days in Liverpool to crowds packed into the legendary underground venue, the Cavern Club. But that version, well, that was played well above ground at the famous impromptu gig on the rooftop of their Apple Company building in London back in 1969. And the Beatles liked it so much, they put it on their second-to-last ever album, Let It Be. Now, earlier from that gig, we played Don't Let Me Down, and that version in which John Lennon messed up the lyrics at one point, and not Paul McCartney, as I said earlier. So thanks so much to those who texted in to tell me the error of my ways, and also apologies to Sir Paul McCartney himself, if he's listening. Yeah, you never know. But that gig was the last time the Beatles ever played live, and a few months later, they'd broken up. But that performance and the time they spent together making the Let It Be album is the focus of Get Back, a project that was compiled from heaps of audio, photos and footage that was captured during those album sessions. 6 hours worth of documentary has been put together by Sir Peter Jackson, and that airs on Disney Plus starting next week. But the task of picking through hundreds of hours of the audio from those sessions for the companion book, well, that fell to the English music writer John Harris. Well, John, Beatles fans out there, I mean, there are a lot of completists. I mean, getting access to this material, you know, after all these years, there will be so many people keen to get amongst it, and the first official book since Anthology, I believe. Are you feeling a bit of pressure? Because I'm sure that those passionate fans will be going over everything you've written and edited with a fine-tooth comb.
No, I'm not feeling particularly anxious or pressured about it. Beatles fans tend to be a sort of accepting and quite friendly bunch. Some of them are quite kind of meticulous and thoroughgoing about facts and timetables and chronologies and all of that. But, you know, when you write about the Beatles or you're involved in a project like this, that's something you're very aware of. So everything is triple and quadruple checked. But it's not a book of facts, is it? Obviously, I mean, the book is an account of their intimate personal and professional conversations over sort of 3 or 4 weeks, and it's there. I mean, that, you know, it's not a book full of dates and times and all that. It's the Beatles in a very unvarnished way communicating with each other. I knew myself when I began to look at the material and began to put this together, it felt great. It felt sort of very fresh and new and fascinating. You know, and I look at all this stuff from the perspective of a Beatles fan. I've been a Beatles fan since I was 5 years old. So I sort of got the sense that if I liked it, I could be reasonably confident that other Beatles fans would like it as well. And that's been the response so far. You know, people are responding to the book very warmly, which is lovely.
Oh, that's good. I was fearing that you would get, you know, harsh letters from people pulling you up on the most minor points of fact or whatever.
But... No, and don't forget, if there was any negative feedback in the modern world, I'd hear it straight away. I mean, they'd be deluging in my Twitter feed, wouldn't they? And I haven't had any of that, so I'm tempting fate here.
Yeah, that's right.
I might be deluged with tweets from New Zealand, but thus far it's been all right.
Yeah, Reddit forums being set up as we speak, but no, I'm sure that
exactly,
won't happen.
Exactly.
But John, tell us a little bit about the material that you got, because, I mean, the book is big. They've given you a lot of space, but a lot of it's for the photographs too, which really reinforce exactly what you said there. These are intimate conversations and interactions between, you know, the four most famous musicians in the world and some of their inside circle, all cooped up together, making some very special music that just about everyone on the planet knows now. How much of this material did you get?
It was an amazing job done on this. I mean, the first thing to make clear to your listeners is that obviously your fellow New Zealander Peter Jackson for the last 4 years has been involved in the documentary film side of the Get Back project, which is about to come out, right? Mm-hmm. So the book is another aspect of that project, which also includes a lot of work on audio packages and unheard music and so on. But the book has been put together as a separate thing from the film. It's not like Peter Jackson was working on this archive and then sending bits of it to me to turn into the printed word. It wasn't like that at all. It was a kind of separate thing, but it originated in the same material. So Apple had this, the Beatles organization had and still have this huge archive of somewhere in the region of about 56 hours of film. But because tape recorders were running while the Beatles were recording and being filmed the whole time, recording all their conversations as well as their music, There were around about 120 hours of audio. I eventually was furnished with a great stack of spiral-bound volumes, one for each day of January 1969 when the Beatles were working, which were full transcripts. And then I got digital copies on Word documents of that. And my job was to turn this into what was conceived of quite quickly between me and the Beatles organisation as a sort of real-life three-act play. I said, well, this is like dialogue in a play. And the story has the same arc as a good play, you know. And we sort of took it from there, and that's how it worked. Later on, I got an iPad, which had been handled by Peter Jackson's organisation, Wingnut, which had all the film rushes on it for me to sort of cross-reference my material. But the lion's share of what I did was all about audio and text. It wasn't about moving pictures.
Some of the images in particular will look familiar to people who've seen the Let It Be feature film, which came out all those years ago. Funny that the review of that in The Observer at the time, 1970, says this film is a bore, shot without any design, clumsily edited. It would have destroyed a lesser group, but there they are, charming the pants off the most cynical of pop music haters because the music's so good. But it says, you know, the reviewer here says the film's supposed to show how the Beatles work, but it doesn't.
I mean, that's hard and unfair on Let It Be, the original movie, you know. That isn't really right. It's not right at all. I mean, Let It Be was much misunderstood because it's a film of the Beatles in January 1969 that was finally released in the spring of 1970, mere weeks after Paul McCartney had announced that the Beatles were over. So it was sort of interpreted along those lines as this being this sort of endlessly miserable film. And it's not really like that at all. I mean, it actually is a pretty good portrait of the way the Beatles were. And there's only one obvious moment of tension within it, because there were other moments of tension that happened during that time. But all of it was so sensitive and raw that couldn't be included in the film.
What you've got here, these intimate conversations and images all together, really does show them at work together.
Yeah, you know, it is that. And Peter Jackson's 6 hours, even more so, obviously, you know. I was at a big screening of that in London last night, watching about an hour and a half of Peter Jackson's work. And that's all been restored, and it has a vividness and clarity that perhaps the original Let It Be film didn't, because that's been done using Peter Jackson's amazing techniques. And also the 6 hours of it. So you can really immerse yourself in the Beatles and their creativity. Michael Lindsay-Hogg, the original director of Let It Be, I think the final film was an hour and 20 minutes, which isn't very long. So in the book and in these new films, and in fact this very exhaustive audio package, there's a 6 CD version of it. You really are deep into the Beatles, who they are and how they make their music. That's true. Deeper than we've ever been before.
And I'm thinking at the time they've come together here, this is early 1969, they are, you know, absolute superstars, of course, by this point. They've long stopped touring. They're just recording, composing, getting together, perhaps not as often as they had before. The White Album was out and they were preparing for a TV special. But I was thinking, to me, I would have thought, look, these guys are superstars. They can do what they want. Here they are coming together just like any bunch of musicians sitting together a few feet apart in the studio and working. But their actual lives were a little bit turbulent at that time, weren't they? George had been away in the USA, as you've said in the material in the book. Paul had got a new relationship with Linda Eastman, later Linda McCartney. John had been dragged through the courts with this cannabis case and you know, was his Yoko Ono had suffered a miscarriage. There was a lot going on with their lives at this time, you know, when they're all settled, hunkered down together, working on all this new music that became Let It Be and the Rooftop gig.
One thing to say to that is there was probably never a time in the Beatles' collective existence when it wasn't sort of turbulent and action-packed. You know, they lived life at sort of five times the speed of the rest of us. So there was always stuff going on. I agree with you that this sort of phase of their career was particularly sort of turbulent and action-packed. But the thing about the Beatles is they just move really, really fast. I mean, you just said it had been ages since they played live, and it seems like that, because when they played live for the last time in August 1966, they were still playing, oh, you know, relatively old songs. She's a Woman, I think. What else? Babies in Black. You know, they weren't quite the Mop Tops, but outwardly they weren't that far off. And this feels the first phase of their career in early 1969 feels 1,000 miles away from all that. But it's only 2.5 years. It's not even that. So what's that from now? That's like talking about, what, 2018? I mean, it's nothing, really. It's just that they move at an accelerated pace. They never have much time off. And so they finish the White Album, and that gets released. And then a matter of weeks later, they're onto this new thing, which on the face of it is tremendously ambitious. And if they were U2 or Coldplay or Adele or anybody, they'd have finished their equivalent of the White Album, and then they've had 3 years off. Then they've gone and sat on their bums in the south of France. But the Beatles don't do that. They just keep on.
But one thing in the conversations that you've got there in your part of the book, that really comes across, because you've got them having quite strange little intimate conversations that possibly only make sense to them, you know, all sorts of weirdness. And then you'll have the brackets open and said, at this point, you know, Paul sits at the piano and starts playing for the first time to the rest of the band, you know, the opening bars of Golden Slumbers or something like that. And you think, oh my goodness, these songs that everybody knows are actually being hammered out in this environment. And you really get a sense of, you know, how they're working. And actually, that they're working hell of a hard.
Oh, yeah. And the other thing is their creativity is not affected by these accelerated lives and how much they have to do. I mean, the Beatles never dry up, and the quality of their material never really drops. And so Paul and George in this period in particular, music's pouring out of them. You know, George turns up one day and says, oh, I wrote a rocking song last night. It's pretty good. And he sits down at the piano and he plays Old Brown Shoe. Whenever Paul is on his own at the piano, something seems to happen. As you said, there are things that later will appear on Abbey Road, things from his solo career, The Backseat of My Car he plays at one point. I think A Bit of Another Day, which was his first post-Beatles single. He starts playing that. So, you know, the amount of material that you hear in the course of this experience of me sitting at home listening to these audio recordings, it was just astonishing. And it explains the origins of some of these songs and how much things have got wrong very often. Everybody thinks Carry That Weight from Abbey Road is a conscious song about the end of the Beatles, and they're all singing about the weight being the Beatles. In other words, for the rest of their life, they will carry the weight of the Beatles. Everybody has thought that for the last 50 years. What I discovered listening to these tapes was that Carry That Weight was just a sort of knockabout, somewhat throwaway country song that he thought Ringo might sing along the lines of Act Naturally. It just so happened that it was put on Abbey Road, and that was everyone's interpretation. So all the time I was getting this sense of, oh, that's the story of that song. We didn't know that.
Yeah, and everyone who of a certain age will have a connection to this music or something. For me, I mean, you talked about, I think, discovering it a bit later. Obviously, you weren't of the Beatles era contemporaneous to them. But I think it was 1981, you said you picked up Let It Be. And so,
I did, as a youngster.
I mean, for me, there's photographs in there. I think it's Mal Evans hitting the anvil in the recordings, I guess, or rehearsals of Maxwell's Silver Hammer. And that triggered in me the fact that my primary school in suburban Wellington in New Zealand, we used to sing that in assemblies, which, when you consider the lyrical material...
You sang songs about a serial killer in school assembly. That's quite a thing.
I know. And we sang it all, you know, sitting on the floor of the hall. And, I mean, this is, you know, mid-70s. And this only a few years after it came out. I'm thinking, how on earth does this bunch of people working together in this weird... weird sort of mutton chop hairy guy with a hammer and sort of NHS looking spectacles. How 5, 6, 7 years later am I singing that as a tiny kid in my primary school along with all my friends? It's a bit odd.
It's amazing all that. I mean, equally, you know, there they were. They filmed and recorded Let It Be. They showed it on British TV twice in the 1970s, and I must have seen it. And then when I was on a family holiday, because I was aware of that music and the film, that was the first Beatles album I bought, which is sort of a strange place to start. But it was kind of why it was an honour, a real honour to be asked to do this job. But you're right, because they're the Beatles, their songs have these early stories about how they were created, how they came into the world. And then there's all these subsequent thousands and millions of stories about what then happens to the songs in all our lives. And I think that's sort of unique to the Beatles. I don't think there's anyone else gets close to that sort of quality of their music.
In all the conversations, when they're together in the studio there, that you're part of the book, it could have been a hell of a lot more surreal than that. The original plan was to have this TV special, but actually to go to Libya and do two performances there, one of which might have been to an empty arena another one with an audience, that at one point they were talking about getting their own cruise ship or something to take an audience out there, which was an idea George evidently hated, given the transcripts of the conversations you've got.
Yeah, that's true. So it's partly because the Beatles didn't have a manager. Brian Epstein tragically had died in 1967. So when they had an idea, it was also, as it wouldn't be with any sort of big rock group now, it was sort of down to them, as well as having the idea, to sort of make it happen. And so some of the conversations in the book, particularly about this idea of sailing to North Africa and performing in a Roman amphitheatre, they're about the logistics of it. And you get this sense of like, what, you want to do this in about 2 weeks' time? In 2 weeks, you want to sail to North Africa in an ocean liner with all your stuff. And I mean, you know, as a spectacle, it would have been incredible. It's effectively the idea for Pink Floyd Live at Pompeii, which is quite a famous concert film, which happened 2 or 3 years later. It's a sort of, I think Pink Floyd nicked it, is my intuition about this. But it would have been magnificent, but you couldn't do it on 2 weeks' notice. And at one point, John Lennon says, well, we can get an ocean liner. P&O will lend us one for the promotion. And George says, well, what do you mean? Fender won't even give us free amplifiers.
And then George didn't want to do it because he feared being stuck on a boat, a bloody big boatload of people for 2 weeks that you couldn't get away from.
There is that. I mean, who likes going on? I mean, you know, imagine the cruise from hell. I mean, you can sort of see his point. Somewhat, but there again, when you see images of the amphitheatre in Sabratha, is the name of the Roman town or city, the ancient site, it would have been astonishing. John Lennon in particular is very taken with that. He says, imagine playing so that everything's timed, so that you hit the middle eight of the song just as the sun comes up over the amphitheatre. You know, I can see exactly, I mean, when you read this, you can see exactly where he's coming from. They were never going to get that together in 2 weeks. No, so all these other locations are talked about, the Albert Hall and a bandstand in Hyde Park and Primrose Hill, which is a park in central London. There are lots of other locations that are discussed.
In the end, they just went up on the roof, which was cool, of Apple HQ. But, you know, at one point, you know, Yoko Ono is suggesting, look, do it all to empty chairs, you know, out in Libya in the arena. It'll be more dramatic. And a bit later, you know, then they start interspersed with all this. They're actually rehearsing and trying out the music that became, you know, the Let It Be album, which and workshopping it, which is kind of weird. And then coming back to this idea, at one point Ringo's saying, oh, I don't know, should you be putting rock and roll in Tahiti or where it is you want to put it, Tripoli, Tunisia, what is it? And then he starts talking about Gibraltar. At this point I'm thinking, are they for real or is this all just a joke between them? But I mean, you realise they're absolutely serious.
Yeah, I think in the moment they are very seriously discussing what they're going to do. And it's quite a difficult conversation because there's the question of who will be prepared to go where. Ringo doesn't seem very keen on leaving the UK, neither does George. But then in addition, George isn't very keen on playing live at all. And so it somewhat falls to Paul to pull off this amazing job, which he successfully does, of orientating these four quite diverse individuals in roughly the same direction. So as A, they complete enough songs to have a sort of body of work from this period, and B, the film gets finished with a finale. And it's a miracle, really. Because don't forget as well, all the songs have started from scratch. Again, a less ambitious group would say, well, we'll play a gig, our first gig for 2 years or whatever, and we'll play a load of stuff that we know from our last few records. No, the idea here is everything's going to be new. I mean, it's an impossible task, but they pull it off in the sense that this ends up being one of the most prolific phases of their career.
In terms of the interaction between them, with, you know, this very intimate atmosphere they're in, at times, you know, because they know each other, it's hard for the outsider to work out as they read the transcripts. Is Paul really having a go at George here, or is this a gag between them? And then Ringo saying things which, when written down, don't make a lot of sense. And he appears to say not an awful lot. But, you know, as you mentioned earlier, there is something I think you feel is a misinterpretation, that this was a time of resentment, that this was all, you know, this period of their history, they were building up to a, you know, the breakup of the group, and, you know, it's been described as a time of tension and so on. I think Paul McCartney might have even described it as such. Do you think that's wrong, and that if when we read the interactions between them, albeit that they're hard to interpret sometimes, because sometimes they're pulling each other's leg when they're using harsh language. Other times, you know, it might be tense. It's hard to tell. What is the relationship like between the four of them, you know, during these recordings?
So first of all, about the book, in putting the book together, one of the great things about having the audio was you could check people's tone of voice and get a sense of, as you say, whether it was humorous or not. And where appropriate, as there would be in a play, there are sort of italicized indications of that. So it will say in the book humorously or playfully or whatever. So hopefully you get a sense of when they mean it and when they don't. The bigger question about tension and to what extent that was the whole picture. The point is there were moments of tension. George, on their second Friday at Twickenham Film Studios, which is where all this started, he walked out. He said, see you around the clubs, and he walked out. And there followed meetings and so on. And he soon came back, it seems, with various conditions, like the idea of this spectacular live show being set to one side.
Mm-hmm.
But there are moments of tension. And they talk, particularly in between George leaving and coming back, they talk very, Paul and John in particular, talk very candidly about the prospect of the group breaking up, how they feel about that, how history will sort of understand their breakup if it happens. Some of those conversations are very emotional. You know, so I think the world only seems to, or the media now, only seems to understand things in like absolute opposing binaries. So when news came that the Get Back project was on and you know, there was a sort of return to this period and this material, there's been this sort of conversation about, well, everyone understood it as being dreadful and miserable, but the truth was it was absolutely happy and ecstatic and all that. And neither one of those is true. The whole thing is really complicated and nuanced and fascinating. And like any family, because that's what they are, really, they have moments of discord and disagreement and tension. But for the most part, the truth is that they get on very well in this period. They're still several months away from breaking up. The business tensions that really, really were sort of sent them in that direction haven't really entered the frame yet. And they're still collaborating really well, and they're still being sort of collectively creative. And there are lots of moments of humor and levity and all the rest of it. But there are also difficult moments. And they themselves are sort of emotionally literate enough and intelligent enough as regards their own sort of understanding themselves and who they are as a group and all that, to say, well hold on, if we're not careful, we're going to break up here. Is that something we want? I mean, there are sort of conversations that are very much along those lines. I mean, I've had half a lifetime of interviewing musicians. They don't tend to be the most emotionally sensitive creatures. A lot of them are terribly emotionally constipated. And you can put an elephant in the room and it'll take them 3 weeks for anyone to say, what's that elephant doing here? And the Beatles aren't like that. They have an amazing mutual respect. They care about each other. You can really tell that as well. And they care about the group. And so they talk about all this stuff. Then it's not, in a very long-winded way, what I'm saying here is, the relationship is many things, but it's not dysfunctional, right? They might be on the, we're starting to sense now that they're growing apart and all the rest of it, but the relationship isn't dysfunctional. They talk about their troubles.
Yeah, because we can misinterpret this. There's one exchange, I think it's Paul, when they're talking about this fabulous Libyan ambitious concert they want to do, which didn't end up happening, but Ringo says he doesn't want to go abroad and kind of puts his foot down, and Paul is sort of saying, okay, so maybe we'll get Jimmy Nicol to come with us. And, you know, Jimmy Nicol being the stand-in drummer when Ringo had tonsillitis. And correct, I read that as like, no, this isn't saying, oh, all right, well, don't come, we'll get someone else. Not that, but this was you know, pulling his leg, basically.
No, that's humorous. But by the same token, there are other occasions when sitting in a sort of circle after George has left, when they're talking very frankly about their situation and where it's all going, where none of it's a sort of put on. It's not banter, to use a modern word. It's very bracingly honest. I think that just the point is, we don't allow people we understand sort of mythologically, we don't allow it to be complicated. Very often it's kind of, it was all going great, then it was all going awful, final triumph, and then they disappeared into the sunset. And because the Beatles are these amazingly complicated human beings, the picture is just much more nuanced and therefore all the more interesting. That's what made it, putting the book together, even more interesting. All the layers of stuff, you know, it's not, there's no sulks, they don't shout at each other. Nothing is simple. It's all very, very complicated and fascinating.
Now, you mentioned there, John, that you've spent half a lifetime interviewing musicians and, you know, peeling layers off them, I guess, and getting to know them. But you have taken great pains to cite your writing about music within a context of politics as well. I mean, you write about politics with a real passion, sometimes not about music at all. And I've been following your stuff and films like the series that you've done, online videos, Anywhere But Westminster, for example, during Brexit. I mean, in those films, you're looking pretty downcast. You're clearly not happy with the way that all played out.
Oh, don't say that.
Well, I'll give you one example, and it does have a musical sort of theme in it. I think one from back in May. You went back to Birmingham, and you intercut previous ones. You said when you'd started out making these films, this is where you went to central Birmingham. You got used to vox pops, talking to people about political and social issues. And then going back there, you found the big banners advertising upcoming gigs for UB40, you know, a Birmingham band, so I guess playing big arenas in their hometown, and making the point that, you know, that band was named after the form you filled out to claim unemployment benefit back in the 1980s, that their big hit song, well, one of them, 1 in 10, was a reference to the number of people unemployed back then in, you know, Thatcher's Britain or whatever we want to call it for shorthand, and that now, in Brexit Britain, the rate of unemployment's pushing something like 1 in 7, I think.
At that point in the West Midlands, the rate of unemployment, which it was partly to do with the pandemic as well, but things were and still are difficult. Yeah, yeah. And I think you're right. I mean, that was the combination, really, of these early signs of the sort of negative effects of Brexit on the economy here. And that makes it sound too abstract. Because, you know, not that anyone's starving, but some people are. But it's not that anyone can't get food, period, right? It's not like that. But there are food shortages here now, as some of your listeners will know, but it's because of Brexit. And at that point, the early stirrings of that were sort of fusing with the fact the pandemic was still with us. And obviously in Britain, unlike New Zealand, there was no zero COVID policy. So people were sort of living with the virus around them, and we were sort of ricocheting from lockdown, out of lockdown, and back in again. And the other thing that's changed really in the last 25 years is that, let alone since 1969, since the Beatles period we're talking about, is that people are much more conversant in the language of mental health and well-being. So you can have a conversation with someone on a shopping street with a microphone, and it can become quite personal quite quickly, you know. And they'll say, and they do say in the film you mentioned, my mental health has been terrible. So it was a kind of a bleak period, that. But it needed pointing out, I think, because we were just leaving a lockdown at that point, and I think there was still a lot of, it's great, you know, we'll soon be free again. And the job of our films, very often, this reflects our whole conversation, really, is to say, well, actually, it's a lot more complicated than that. And it still is here. It's really, really complicated and weird.
In calling the series Anywhere But Westminster, I mean, your object is to get out into the places that perhaps are, you know, underrepresented. You know, you still have a bit of a London and a parliamentary focus on your politics. There's one scene when you come out of a Labour Party annual conference, just talking about, you know, the experience being absolutely deadening.
Yeah, that's where that whole approach, I mean, I don't know, big ourselves up too much. I mean, what we do is journalism. You know, you hit town and you go and find some people and you say, what's it like living here? And what's going well and what's not going so well? And then, via people's everyday experiences, much further down the line in the conversation, you then start talking about who they're going to vote for and so on. And so with any luck, and we think it works, you get a much more sort of authentic, deep idea of what motivates people politically, as opposed to what the TV here does, which is they tend to go down the street and grab someone and throw them against the wall and say, what do you think of the Labour Party? I mean, that's not a normal conversation. So we hit town and say, how are you doing? What's it like here? You know, how do you feel about the future and all that? And that whole approach was born from our absolute deathly frustration, really, with trying to do orthodox or relatively orthodox political journalism, which once a year was these awful annual party conferences in these sort of sealed off security zones, no natural light, and having to listen to politician speeches all day. So it didn't seem real. And us exiting that world and going out into reality happened as a matter of chance, really, to coincide with politics and society, for that matter, in Britain, becoming suddenly very, very unpredictable and complicated, which led on to the vote on Scottish independence in 2014, the Brexit referendum in 2016. We seem to have an election every couple of years here now. You know, it's a very sort of turbulent, volatile time here still. And the best place to understand all that is not close to centres of power, away from it. You have to be in the thick of it. And that's the idea of the series. We've just made a film about the Beatles in 1969, which was commissioned by the Beatles organisation, which uses the vox pop technique that we've spent 10 years doing, because there are vox pops in Let It Be and in the new Get Back film. There are vox pops in that. So we've sort of used our own vox pop techniques. But the glorious relief of it, instead of walking up and down the street asking people about COVID and Brexit, we ask them about the Beatles, which is lovely.
It is. And it's a lovely place to end it. Thank you so much, John Harris. Thanks for joining us. We will love looking at the book. Hope people get to see it. And I do hope, as we mentioned earlier, that we haven't now sparked lots of Beatles completists from New Zealand to bombard you online and on social media with their interpretation.
Get in touch if you need to.
Wonderful.
I can handle it.
Okay, John, that's an open invitation to cyberbully John Harris via whatever forum you can if you disagree with his interpretation of the internal dynamics of the Beatles in early 1969. Cheers, John. Thanks so much for your time
today. Thank you. Thanks a lot.